Picture a Saturday afternoon. Clear sky, light wind, the kind of day you planned around all week. You're 2.5 hours into a cross-country in a Cessna 172, the airport's finally in sight, and you glance at the fuel gauges. Both needles are hovering right down near the bottom of the yellow, and a little voice in the back of your head says, "Well, we made it, didn't we?" Here's the thing, if you're reading the gauges on final and hoping, you already broke the rule, and more importantly, you already gave away the margin that was supposed to keep you alive. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Pattern, and today on Traffic Pattern, we're going to talk about one of the shortest, plainest regulations in the whole book, and one that quietly shows up in a startling number of accident reports. Federal Aviation Regulation 91-151, the VFR Fuel Reserve Rule. Let's walk through this together, because this is one of those rules that sounds like paperwork and is actually about survival. Before we get into it, a quick shout out to our friends at aviationsoul.com. They make challenge coins for every step of the journey. Got your first solo? There's a coin for that. Private pilot, instrument commercial, they've got you covered. It's a great way to mark the milestones that matter. And honestly, the day you truly understand fuel planning is one of those milestones nobody hands you a coin for, but maybe they should. aviationsoul.com. Okay, let's read the rule, because it's short enough that you have no excuse not to know it. The Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, writes it like this: no person may begin a flight in an airplane under visual flight rules unless, considering wind and forecast weather conditions, there is enough fuel to fly to the first point of intended landing, and assuming normal cruising speed to fly after that for at least 30 minutes during the day or 45 minutes at night. That's it. That's the whole thing. Now let me translate that out of lawyer and into cockpit. You need enough fuel to get where you're going. Then, on top of that, you need a reserve still sitting in the tanks after you land. 30 minutes of reserve if it's a daytime flight, 45 minutes if it's night. And by the way, if you fly helicopters, that reserve is 20 minutes day or night, but for most of us listening in airplanes, it's 30 and 45. Here's the part people miss. That reserve is not fuel you're allowed to use. It's not a cushion you dip into on the way. It is fuel that has to still be there, unburned, when you shut down at your destination. The rule is written so that if everything goes according to plan, you land with 30 or 45 minutes of gas you never touched. Let me say that again, because it's the whole ballgame. The reserve is measured at the end of the flight, not at the start. So why does that matter so much? Because flights don't go according to plan. That's the entire reason the reserve exists. The headwind is stronger than forecast. The airport you're headed to has a runway closed and you get vectored the long way around. There's traffic and the tower has you extend your downwind for what feels like a week. You get up there and the visibility's dropping and you decide, smartly, to divert to the field 20 miles behind you. Every one of those eats into your fuel. The reserve is what turns all of those normal, ordinary complications into a non-event instead of an emergency. Here's something I wish someone told me when I was training. Fuel exhaustion and fuel starvation are two different killers, and the reserve rule protects you from the first one. Let me explain the difference, because your examiner may well ask, and more importantly, because it changes how you think. Fuel exhaustion means the tanks are actually dry. You burned it all. There's nothing left to give the engine. Fuel starvation means there's fuel on board somewhere, but it's not getting to the engine. Maybe you ran one tank dry and didn't switch to the fuller one in time. Maybe a fuel selector is in the wrong position. Starvation is usually a systems and procedures problem. Exhaustion is a planning problem, and 91-151 is aimed squarely at the planning problem. Now, here's the uncomfortable truth. Running out of gas is almost entirely preventable, and it still happens every single year to certificated pilots who knew the rule cold. The National Transportation Safety Board sees these accidents over and over. And when you read the reports, it's almost never a person who did the math and decided to gamble. It's a person who never did the math at all, or who did it once at the start and never updated it when the wind changed. So let's make you a better fuel planner than that. Let's walk through how this actually works on your next flight. Start with knowing your airplane's real burn rate, not the number in the marketing brochure, the number you see in the operating handbook for your power setting and altitude, and honestly, the number you verified yourself by watching the tanks over time. A trainer might burn 8 gallons an hour, a bigger single might burn 12, 14 more. You have to know yours. If a friend asked you right now, sitting in your living room, how many gallons an hour your airplane burns in cruise, you should be able to answer without thinking. If you can't, that's your homework tonight. Then you figure your time on route and you add your taxi and takeoff and climb fuel, which burns richer and faster than cruise. Climb is thirsty, don't forget it. Then, and this is the step people skip, you convert your reserve requirement into gallons, 30 minutes at your burn rate. If you're burning 10 gallons an hour, 30 minutes is 5 gallons, 45 minutes at night is 7.5. That's the fuel that has to still be in the tanks. Draw a line right there, that's not usable trip fuel, that's untouchable. And here's where I'm going to push you past the regulation. The rule is a legal minimum. It is the floor, not the goal. 30 minutes of reserve sounds like a lot until you're circling a fogged-in airport at night doing the mental math on whether you can make the alternate. Most experienced pilots I know set a personal minimum well above the legal one. An hour in the tanks when they land, some won't let a tank go below a quarter without a plan. The regulation keeps you legal. Your personal minimum keeps you comfortable, and comfortable is where good decisions get made. Scared and low on fuel is where bad ones happen. Let me give you a real scenario, the kind that sneaks up on good pilots. You plan a 2-hour flight. Your airplane holds, let's say, enough for a little over 4 hours, so you think, plenty, I've got double what I need, you take off. But the winds aloft forecast was optimistic, and you've got a 20-knot headwind that nobody promised you. Your 2-hour flight is now 2 hours and 35 minutes. Then your destination has a training flight doing closed traffic, and the tower asks you to hold, and you burn another 10 minutes just going in circles. Then, on top of all that, the sun went down while you were en route, so the reserve you needed just quietly jumped from 30 minutes to 45. None of those things is an emergency by itself. Stack them up, and the pilot who launched with 4 hours and a shrug is now genuinely sweating. The pilot who did the running math, who checked the fuel against the clock at every checkpoint, saw the headwind eating into the plan an hour ago and already decided to make a quick fuel stop. Same airplane, same weather, completely different afternoon. That's the mindset I want you to carry. Fuel planning isn't a thing you do once on the ground with a pencil. It's a thing you keep doing in the air. At every checkpoint, you ask one question. Given what the tanks and the clock are actually telling me right now, not what I planned this morning, do I still land with my reserve? The moment the answer gets fuzzy, you land and buy gas. Gas is cheap. It is astonishingly, laughably cheap compared to the alternative. Now, a couple of practical points that trip students up. First, those fuel gauges. Federal regulations only require that your fuel gauges read accurately when the tanks are empty. Let that sink in. The one moment they're guaranteed to be honest is the exact moment you least want to be finding out. So you do not plan fuel by staring at the gauges. You plan by known quantity and time. You start with a known amount of fuel. You know your burn rate. You watch the clock. The gauges are a backup, a sanity check, a way to catch a leak or a problem. They are not your primary fuel plan. Time and known quantity are. Second, visually confirm your fuel before you fly. Take the cap off. Look in the tank. Use a fuel stick if you've got one. Don't take the last pilot's word for it. Don't trust a gauge. Look. The most reliable fuel measurement in the whole airplane is your own eyeball on a known tab or a calibrated stick. Third, and this connects to a rule we've talked about before on this show, 91103, pre-flight action. That reg says you must become familiar with all available information before a flight, and fuel is a huge piece of that. The winds aloft, the weather, the runway situation at your destination, all available information includes the stuff that tells you whether your fuel plan is realistic. These regulations aren't separate islands. They talk to each other. Now, a word for those of you working on the instrument rating, because the fuel rule changes when you go into the clouds. Under instrument flight rules, that's a different regulation, 91167. Under IFR, you need enough fuel to fly to your destination, then to fly to your alternate airport if one is required, and then to fly for 45 minutes after that at normal cruise, day or night. IFR is 45 minutes on top of the alternate. It's a bigger cushion, because instrument flying puts you in exactly the situations low weather holds, missed approaches where you'll need it. Different number, same philosophy. Land with gas to spare. So what does the examiner want to see on your check ride? The examiner is looking for a pilot who treats fuel as a hard number, not a hopeful one. On your cross-country planning, they want to see you calculate your fuel burn, add your reserve as an explicit quantity, and know whether you're legal and safe. They may throw a scenario at you. The wind's picked up, your alternate's now farther, walk me through your decision. What they are really testing is whether you'll be the pilot who catches the problem at altitude with options still on the table, or the one who discovers it on short final with none. The airman certification standards spell this out under cross-country planning and risk management. It's not a trick, they're just checking that you'll come home. Let me leave you with the simplest version of all of this, the thing to carry in your head. The reserve is not yours to spend 30 minutes in the day, 45 at night, still in the tanks when you land. Plan by time and known quantity, never by the gauges. Recheck it in the air, not just on the ground. And when in doubt, put it on the ground and buy gas. Nobody has ever stood on a ramp, tanks topped off, and regretted the fuel stop. Plenty of people have wished they'd made one. Learning to fly is hard, and it's expensive, and I know a fuel stop feels like it's costing you time and money you'd rather not spend. But this is the one place where I will never ever tell you to cut it close. Thanks to the FAA and the National Transportation Safety Board for the regulations and the accident data that make a segment like this worth doing. You can find us anytime at RadioHangar.com. Check your tanks, know your numbers, and land with more than you think you need. I'll see you back in the pattern.